Sitting in a chair across the coffee table from him in Suite 12, her expression changed little. Perhaps her eyes grew a little wider. "And," Fletch said, "I think I do understand." He had appeared at her door carrying the marvelous machine. She had answered the door, still dressed in black, having returned from the memorial service shortly before. Near the door was a luncheon tray waiting to be taken away. At first, she looked at him in surprise, as it was an unseemly time to call. Then she obviously remembered he had promised they would talk again about his working for March newspapers, and the suitcase in his hand suggested he was about to leave. He said nothing. Sitting on the divan, he placed the marvelous machine flat on the coffee table. Now he was opening it. "Statistically, of course," he said, "in the case of a domestic murder, and this is a domestic murder, when a husband or wife is murdered, chances of the spouse being the murderer are something over 70%. Perhaps her eyes widened again when she saw that what was in the suitcase was a tape recorder. "Which is why," Fletch said, "you chose to murder your husband here at the convention, where you knew your husband would be surrounded by people who had reason to hate him to the point of murder." Her back was straight. Her hands were folded in her lap. "Listen to this." Fletch started the tape recorder. It was the tape of Lydia March being questioned by Captain Neal, edited. "At what time did you wake up, Mrs. March?" "I'm not sure. 7:15, 7:20. I heard the door to the suite close." "That was me, Mr. Neal," Junior said. "I went down to the lobby to get the newspapers." Walter had left his bed. It's always been a thing with him to be up a little earlier than I, a masculine thing. I heard him moving around the bathroom. I lay in bed a little while, a few minutes really, waiting for him to be done. "The bathroom door was closed?" "Yes, in a moment I heard the television here in the living room go on, softly, one of those morning news and features network shows Walter always hated so much, so I got up and went into the bathroom." "Excuse me, how did your husband get from the bathroom to the living room without coming back through your bedroom?" "He went through Junior's bedroom, of course. He didn't want to disturb me." "Okay, you were in the bathroom. The television was playing softly in the living room." "I heard the door to the suite close again, so I thought Walter had gone down for coffee."
"Had the television gone off?"
"No."
"So, actually, someone could have come into the suite at that point."
"No. At first I thought Junior might have come back, but he couldn't have."
"Why not?"
"I didn't hear them talking."
"Would they have been talking, necessarily?"
"Of course."
"So, Mrs. March, you think you heard the suite door close again, but your husband hadn't left the suite, and you think no one entered the suite because you didn't hear talking?"
"I guess that's right. I could be mistaken, of course. I'm trying to reconstruct."
"Pardon, but where were you physically in the bathroom when you heard the door close the second time?"
"I was getting into the tub."
"You had already run the tub?"
"Yes, while I was brushing my teeth, and all that."
"So there must have been a period of time while the tub was running that you couldn't have heard anything from the living room. Not the front door, not the television, not talking."
"Well, I suppose not."
"So the second time you heard the door close, when you were getting into the tub, you actually could have been hearing someone leave the suite."
"Oh my, that's right, of course."
"It would explain your son's not having returned, your husband's not having left, and you're not hearing talking."
"How clever you are."
Fletch switched off the marvelous machine. Listening, Lydia March's eyes had gone back and forth from the slowly revolving tape reel to Fletch's face. Fletch said, "When I first arrived at Hendricks' plantation, and Helena Williams was telling me about the murder, I noticed she particularly mentioned what you had heard from the bathroom. I think she said something about your hearing gurgling and thinking it was the tub drain. Not precisely what you said here, but Helena could have reported what you heard from the bathroom only if you had made a point of telling her." Fletch rested his back against a divan pillow. "Captain Neal wasn't a bit clever," he said. "He never went into the bathroom to discover what could be heard from there."
"I did.
Last night when I came to visit you, you and Jake Williams were talking here in the living room. I went into the bathroom. The doors of both bedrooms to the living room were open, which gave me a much better chance to hear than you supposedly had. I closed both bathroom doors. I did not run water. I did not flush the toilet. I listened. Mrs. March, I could not hear you and Jake talking. You could not have heard the television, especially on low. I did not hear Jake leave the suite. You could not have heard the door closing, as you said you did. Perhaps your hearing is better than mine, but my hearing is 40 years younger than yours. As Oscar Perlman might say, I have 20/20 hearing. Mrs. March, the closets to both bedrooms are between the bathroom and the living room. Architects do this on purpose, so you cannot hear. You made too much of an issue of the front door of the suite being open. You gave evidence you couldn't have had. It was important for you to convince everyone that you heard the door close when Junior left the suite, but that it was open when you came into the living room. You lied. Why? Despite everything we know about your husband, how badly he treated people, his private detectives, his sense of security, you had to convince people he had opened the door to someone else who stabbed him in the back. Simplicity. The simple truth is that there were two of you in a suite with the door to the corridor closed and locked, and one of you was stabbed. Who did it? He leaned forward again and again pressed the play button on the tape recorder. Lydia March's voice came from the speakers. There was a man in the corridor, walking away, lighting a cigar as he walked. I didn't know who he was from behind. I ran toward him. Then I realized who he was. Mrs. March, who was the man in the corridor?
Perlman, Oscar Perlman.
The humorist?
If you say so.
Fletch switched off the machine again. He said, Mrs. March, you made 3 mistakes in laying down potential evidence that Oscar Perlman is your husband's murderer. The first isn't very serious. Perlman says he was playing poker until 5:30 in the morning and then slept late. That he was playing poker until 5:30 in the morning can be confirmed, and I suppose Neil has done so. He could have gotten up, murdered your husband, and gone back to bed or whatever, but it doesn't seem likely. A much more serious mistake you made is in the timing of it all. According to your story, someone stabbed your husband in the living room. Sitting in the bathtub, you heard choking, whatever, called out, got out of the tub, grabbed a towel, went into the bedroom, saw your husband stagger in from the living room, roll off the bed, drive the scissors deeper into his back, arch up, etc., and die. Then you ran through the bedroom, the living room, and into the corridor. And you try to indicate that the man who might have stabbed your husband is, just at that point, still in the corridor, walking away? You lied. Why? The third mistake you made in saying Oscar Perlman was in the corridor outside the suite is most serious. But I'll come back to that. Again, Fletch settled himself on the divan. He said, Unfortunately for you, the people who had the best motives and opportunity to kill your husband are all highly skilled at handling an interview. They're all reporters. Raleigh Wisham, for example, did nothing to divert suspicion from himself. Oscar Perlman didn't even pretend he had an alibi. Lewis Graham didn't even hesitate to be open, almost indict himself. Even Crystal Fioni was quick to realize she was a possible suspect and didn't hesitate to admit it. Perhaps it was unconscious on their parts, but I think they all have enough experience to have realized instinctively they had all been set up as clay pigeons. By you, by your choice of the time and the place of the murder. I always look for the controlling intelligence behind anything and everything. In this case, it was yours. Why? Why? Lydia March continued sitting primly in her chair. Her head had raised slightly, and she was looking somewhat down her nose at him. In October 1928, you married Walter March, who was due to graduate from Princeton in June 1929. Odd, especially in those days, not to have waited for graduation. Not so odd. Junior was born 5 months later, in March 1929. What was the expression for it in those days, a shotgun marriage? Was Walter March the father of your child? Or, being the heir to a newspaper fortune, was he just the best catch around? Were you sure Walter was the father? Was he? You're a wily woman, Mrs. March. You remained married to Walter March for 50 years, never had another child. There was an enormous newspaper fortune to be inherited. But Walter was an old war horse. He wouldn't give up. Perfect health. He announced his retirement once, and then, when Junior goofed up, didn't retire.
And all this time, as Junior was getting to be 50 years old, losing his wife, his family, drinking more and more, you saw him becoming weaker and weaker, wasting away. Fletch stared a long moment at the floor. Finally, he said, "There is a time for fathers to move aside, to quit, to die, to leave room for their sons to grow. Even if they are just the image of the father rather than the blood father." Walter wasn't moving aside. Did he somehow know instinctively Walter Jr. wasn't his son? Fletch jerked the marvelous machine's wire from the wall socket. "You killed your husband to save your son." He was wrapping up the wire. "Do you know your husband had another son? His name is Joseph Molinaro. Your husband had him with Eleanor Earls, I guess, while she was a student at Barnard. And did you know that Joseph Molinaro is here? He came to see your husband. Maybe another son on the horizon, if you knew it, made you even more desperate to protect your own son." Fletch closed and latched the cover of the suitcase. "Of course, I'm going to have a talk with Captain Neal, if you don't first. By the way," he said, "thanks for the job offer. Same way you marches to everything, either buy people off or blackmail them into a corner. After more than a century of this, you have a most uncanny instinct as to whom to buy off or blackmail." He stood up and picked up the suitcase. "Oh," he said, "the third most terrible mistake you made in saying Oscar Perlman was in the corridor was that you said it in Junior's presence. The big idiot has blown the game again. He's gone and told Captain Neal that Perlman had an appointment to see her husband at 8 o'clock Monday morning." Lydia was looking up at Fletch from her chair. Her expression did not change at all. Fletch said, "You don't understand the significance of that, do you?" Her expression still didn't change. Again, Junior was overdoing the clever bit. Why would he lie to support you unless he knows you were lying? He knows you killed your husband. Her eyes lowered slowly. Her lips tightened and turned down at their corners. Her eyes settled on her hands in her lap. Slowly, her hands opened and turned palms up. "Mrs. March," Fletch said, "you're killing your son." Fletch was almost back to his room, carrying the marvelous machine, before he realized that during the time he had spent with her, Lydia March had not said one word. Chapter 34. 3 p.m. Arrival of the President of the United States. Canceled. Arrival of the Vice President of the United States. Fletch heard the helicopter banging away overhead as he crossed the lobby to the French doors. Most of the conventioners were on the terrace behind Hendrick's plantation house to watch the helicopter land on the lawn. The sunlight brought out the bright colors of their clothes. Mostly they were still chattering about Leona Hatch's insider's report on her 8 terms as a White House reporter. When Fletch came onto the terrace, the helicopter had retreated to the sky over the far ridge of trees. Leona Hatch pulled herself away from an admiring group of young people and approached Fletch. "I'll swear I know you," she said. "With my dying breath, I'll swear." He put his hand out to her. "Fletcher," he said. "Erwin Fletcher." She shook hands limply, her eyes searching his face sharply. "I feel I know you very well," she said. Fletch was looking for Captain Neal. Junior, sallow and slump-shouldered, was standing with Jake Williams watching the helicopter. "I can't get over this feeling, this certainty, that I know you well," Leona Hatch said. "But I can't remember..." Fletch saw Neal standing with some uniformed Virginia State policemen. "Excuse me," he said to Leona Hatch. He touched Neal's elbow. Neal looked at him. The slight expression of annoyance on Neal's face was replaced by a gentle, respectful curiosity. Obviously, Neal was remembering from lunch that Fletch seemed to know more about the murder of Walter March than the others did, and in addition could make some very good guesses. Fletch said quietly, "I think you should go talk with Lydia March." Neal looked at Fletch a moment, probably considering questions to ask, but decided not to ask any. Captain Neal nodded and went through the crowd and into the lobby of the hotel. The helicopter was approaching the lawn below the terrace very slowly. Fletch had been aware that a group of five men, moving together, had come onto the terrace. It was not until they were standing at the front of the terrace, next to Junior and Jake Williams, that Fletch looked directly at the men. Hands in pockets, appearing totally relaxed, watching the helicopter land, was the Vice President of the United States. Helena Williams spotted him the same time Fletch did. She began to rush toward him from the other side of the terrace. What she was saying was drowned out by the noise of the helicopter. Junior, remaining oblivious to the presence of the Vice President of the United States beside him, suddenly rocked back on his heels. He put his hand up to his face as if he were about to sneeze. Fletch saw blood on Junior's neck. Then a splotch of blood appeared on Junior's white shirt, next to his necktie. Fletch started toward Junior. Junior lost his balance and fell against the Vice President. Someone screamed. Jake Williams yelled, "Junior!" Junior rolled as he fell. Landing on his back on the flagstones, the two splotches of blood, on his neck and on his shirt, were clearly visible. Helena was kneeling over him. Even over the sound of the helicopter, Fletch could hear Jake Williams shout, "Someone is trying to kill the Vice President!" One of the four men with the Vice President spun him around toward the hotel. The other three surrounded him closely. One held his hand out behind the Vice President's head, as if to shield him from the sun. They pushed him through the crowd and into the hotel. Crystal Fioni had joined Helena Williams in kneeling over Junior. Crystal was trying to blow air into Junior's mouth. The helicopter had settled on the lawn, and its door was opening. Fletch looked across the lawn and ran his eyes as closely as he could along the line of trees. Men in Marine Corps uniform were getting off the helicopter. At first, Fletch moved very slowly, backing away from the crowd, turning, jumping off the terrace, ambling across the lawn. He did not break into a full run for the stables until he was well concealed by the trees. Chapter 35. Fletch had no plan. He could find no one at the stables, so he saddled the horse he had used twice before, fumbling as he hadn't saddled a horse himself in a long time, alarming the horse with his haste. Once clear of the paddock area, he laid the whip on her and she poured on speed, but only for a very few moments. She was a pleasant horse, but not too swift. Clearly, in all her days on Hendricks' plantation, she had never been asked to be in a sincere hurry. By the time they had climbed the ridge and were approaching the camper along the timber road, she was winded and resentful. Fletch left her in the deep shade of the woods about 20 meters up the hillside from the camper. He still had no plan. The camper was open, but the keys weren't in the ignition. He looked for the keys under the driver's seat, over the visor in the map compartment, then, hurrying, moved back into the camper, flipping over the mattress of the unmade bed, glancing in the cabinets, the oven, under the seat cushions of the two chairs. He went through the pockets of a dark suit, hanging from a curtain rod. On a shelf was an old cigar box. Inside were screws, nails, a few sockets for a wrench, half a pouch of Bull Durham tobacco, and a set of keys, somewhat rusted. He tried the keys in the ignition. The third key on the chain fit. He left it in the ignition. Standing by the camper, he realized he still didn't have a plan. From down the road, around the bend, he heard someone cough. Mentally, Fletch thanked his horse up in the woods for being quiet. Fletch flattened himself against the wall of the camper, next to the rear wheels. He stuck his head out, for a look only once. Joseph Molinaro was walking toward the camper, 10 meters away, a rifle under his right arm. It had not occurred to Fletch before this that, of course, Joseph Molinaro would be carrying a rifle. He had not thought to arm himself. There was no time to go back into the camper. The few branches and stones in the road at his feet were too small and light to make good weapons. He had no more time to think. Fletch had left the camper through the driver's door. Molinaro was at the back of the camper, heading for the door near the right rear wheels. Crouching, looking under the camper, Fletch watched Molinaro's feet. As soon as Molinaro was on the other side of the camper, Fletch moved around to its rear and along its wall. Just as Molinaro was beginning to climb the 3 steps into the camper, beginning to bend his head through the door, Fletch hit him on the back of his head, hard, with the side of his hand. The force of the blow knocked Molinaro's head against the solid doorframe. Instinctively tightening his arm over the rifle, Molinaro fell up the steps, half in and half out of the camper. He rolled over. His eyes remained open only a second or two. He appeared to recognize Fletch. Having already been unconscious once that morning, Molinaro's head settled back on the camper's floor, and he went deeply unconscious. Fletch took the rifle from under his arm and slid it along the floor of the camper toward the front. Picking up Molinaro's legs, Fletch slid his back along the linoleum floor until Molinaro was entirely aboard the camper and the door could be closed. Fletch climbed the steps to the camper and stepped over Molinaro. He tore two strips from the bedsheet and tied Molinaro's ankles together. Then he tied his wrists together in front of him. He slammed the back door of the camper, climbed into the driver's seat, and turned the key in the ignition. The battery was dead. Incredulous, Fletch senselessly tried the key three or four times. He groaned. Molinaro couldn't do anything right. He had come to Virginia to meet his father. Never did meet him. That morning, he had gotten up, flicked a cigarette into a stranger's face, and instantly was knocked unconscious. Then he had let two people know who he was and why he was there. If the suit hanging from the curtain rod was any indication, Joseph Molinaro actually had gone to Walter March's memorial service. Next, using that rifle on the floor with telescopic sights, he had murdered his half-brother. He had ambled back to his camper, not even having thrown the murder weapon away, never thinking someone who had figured out what he had done might be waiting for him. And the battery of his getaway vehicle was dead. Looking at the man with the tight, curly gray hair, dressed in the blue jeans jacket, unconscious and bound on the floor of the camper, Fletch shook his head. Then he climbed the hillside and got his horse. I see you figured it out just a little faster than I did. Before leaving the timber road, Fletch met Frank Gillis heading for the camper. Gillis's horse looked exhausted. Gillis nodded at Molinaro slung over the saddle of Fletch's horse. Is he dead or just unconscious?
Unconscious,
Gillis said. He seems to spend a lot of time in that condition.
Poor son of a bitch.
Walking the horse, Fletch held the reins in his right hand, the rifle in his left. He asked, Junior dead?
Yeah.
Fletch left the road and started through the woods down the hillside. Gillis said, You sure that's the murder weapon? As sure as I can be without a ballistics test. It's the weapon he was carrying when he returned to the camper. Remaining on his horse, Gillis followed Fletch through the woods to the pasture and then rode along beside him. Fletch said, I wonder if you'd mind putting Molinaro on your horse.
Why?
I feel silly. I feel like I'm walking into Dodge City.
So why should I feel silly?
Frank Gillis chuckled.
One of us has to feel silly, and you're the one who caught him, Gillis said.
Thanks.
Why didn't you use the camper?
Dead battery.
Gillis shook his head just as Fletch had.
I don't know, Gillis said. This guy. Did he murder old man March, or did he think Junior murdered him? Or was he just plain jealous of Junior, now that Molinaro's dream of being recognized by his father was over?
Fletch walked along quietly a moment before saying, You'll have to ask Captain Neal, I guess.
You know, Gillis said, everyone thought an attempt was being made on the Vice President's life.
Yeah.
I did too, at first, until I realized this was another March who was dead. Who'd ever want to kill the Vice President of the United States? One could have a greater effect upon national policy by killing the White House cook.
Who was in the helicopter? Fletch asked.
Oh, that. Gillis's chins were quivering with mirth. Some Marine Corps general. He was here for some ceremony or other, a presentation of some kind, pin a medal on someone. And while the general was making this big entrance, landing in a helicopter on the back lawn, the Vice President of the United States was arriving at the front of the hotel in an economy-sized car, completely ignored.
They were both laughing, and Molinaro was still unconscious.
As soon as everyone realized what had happened, the junior had been shot, the Secret Service hustled the Vice President back into his car and back to Washington, and the General climbed aboard his helicopter and took off. The only thing the Vice President was heard to say during his stay at Hendricks' plantation was, My, the military live well.
They came onto the back lawns of Hendricks' plantation. Indeed, the helicopter was gone. People were playing golf on the rolling greens the other side of the plantation house.
You want to carry the rifle? Fletch asked.
No, no, I wouldn't take from your moment of glory.
Fletch said, this isn't glory. Captain Neal saw them from the terrace and came down to the lawn to meet them. A couple of uniformed state policemen followed him. Neal indicated the man across the saddle of Fletch's horse.
Who's that? He asked.
Fletch said, Joseph Molinaro.
Can't be, Neal said. Molinaro's only about 30. Younger.
Still on his horse, Gillis said, look at his face.
Neal lifted Molinaro's head by the hair.
My, my, Neal said. Fletch handed his reins to one of the uniformed policemen. Neal asked Fletch, did Molinaro kill young March? Fletch handed Neal the rifle. Easy to prove. This is the weapon he was carrying. Over Neal's shoulder, Fletch saw Eleanor Earls appear on the terrace.
Did you speak to Lydia March? Fletch asked Neal.
No.
No?
Neal said, she's dead. Overdose. Second all. Eleanor Earls was approaching them. Even at a distance, Fletch could see the set of her face. It seemed frozen.
She left a note, Neal said, to Junior, saying she wouldn't say why, but she had murdered her husband. The key thing is, she said the night they arrived, she went back downstairs to the reception desk to order flowers for the suite and stole the scissors she had seen on the desk when they checked in. Now that he's reminded of it, the desk clerk says he was puzzled at the time why she hadn't telephoned the order down. He had also been slightly insulted because flowers had been put in all the suites and Mrs. March had said the flowers in Suite 3 were simply inadequate. Eleanor Earls was standing near them, staring at the man slung over the saddle. Neal noticed her.
Hey, he said to the uniformed policeman. Let's get this guy off the horse.
Gillis got off his horse to help. Eleanor Earls watched them take Molinaro off the horse and put him on the ground. In a moment, her face still frozen, she turned and walked back toward the hotel. From what Fletch had seen, there was no way Eleanor Earls could have known from that distance whether her son was dead or alive. Chapter 36. Good afternoon, the Boston Star. Jack Saunders, please. Fletch had gone directly to room 102, Crystal Fione's room, and banged on the door. Tired and teary, she opened the door. Fletch guessed that, badly upset by her experience of trying to breathe life into a dead man, into a dead Walter March Jr., Crystal had been napping, fully clad on her bed in the dark room.
Wake up, said Fletch. Cheer up.
Really, Fletch, at this moment I'm not sure I can stand your relentless cheer. He entered her room while she still held onto the doorknob. He pulled the drapes open. Close the door, he said. She sighed and closed the door. What's the best way to get a job in the newspaper business? He asked. She thought a moment. I suppose have a story no one else has. A real scoop. Is this another game? I've got a story for you, he said. A real scoop. And maybe if we work it out right, a job in Boston with Jack Saunders.